you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Welcome in to the Cubs Talk podcast, brought to you by Wintrust, home of Cubs checking with free ATMs nationwide. Find out more at wintrust.com/cubs. I'm Patrick Mooney, csnchicago.com's Cubs insider. We're here with a jam-packed Cubs Talk podcast episode. We got Derek Gould, the longtime Cardinals beat writer for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. We talk about a wide range of topics. We go into kind of where the Cardinals are at now, how Dexter Fowler is liking or maybe not liking the Cardinal way, the state of the National League Central, and also what Mike Matheny and the Cardinals really think about Joe Maddon and try not to suck and all of those Cubway type antics. But first, we got Mick Gillespie. You know him from all the work he does on Cubs.com, broadcasting spring training games. He's also the play-by-play man for AA Tennessee. And he gives us the latest on really what I think is a pressing question of, well, what's left in the farm system now that Theo Epstein has made his big move for Jose Quintana. Mick gets into some of those pitching names that are finally starting to bubble up from beneath the surface. And also a really interesting story about Dylan Maples, this kind of bonus baby who was totally off the radar. Things have clicked for him at AA Tennessee to the point where he's on his way now to AAA Iowa. So for the latest, let's go out to Mick Gillespie. So, Mick, I think the big question Cubs fans have after that Jose Quintana blockbuster deal is, you know, what's left in the farm system? And, you know, with your broadcast work in spring training, the relationships you developed with the Smokies, you always get a ton of scouts coming through your AA affiliate. I guess, what's there? What sort of pieces does Theo have to work with in these last couple weeks before the July 31st trade deadline?
Yeah, it should be interesting. I guess right now the top prospect in my mind would be Adbert Alzolay, who's just gotten to AA and had a 10-strikeout performance in his first game and looked very impressive. And if he continues to develop, over the next four or five starts, I mean, you know, there's no telling, how high his stock could rise. But he looked a lot like Julio Teheran, who pitches for the Braves, coming up when he was so good back then. But, you know, pitching-wise, they still have Dwayne Underwood, who's looked good at times this year. He's been healthy. A lot of scouts will stop me and ask me questions about him. A lot of guys have told me that they've written him up and that they like what they see. Maybe not as a starter long-term, but someone that they could use out of the bullpen. But he's got the ability to start as well. Trevor Clifton's been good. He was the Cubs minor league pitcher of the year last season. He's certainly a piece. He doesn't have jump off the page stuff, but when you watch him over the course of time, he just looks like a major leaguer. So I say as far as pitching goes, if they're going to go out and add pitching, they're probably going to have to give up some. And so those guys, and then Dylan Maples, has had a meteoric rise over the last year. And so he's a reliever. He's a closer now in AA. So as far as the guys who are from AA to AAA up, I would say those are the ones that, in my mind, would be good pieces that the Cubs could move if they wanted to.
I think if Dylan Cease had gotten to Tennessee by this point, I think the Cubs would have been a lot more hesitant to give him up to the White Sox, it's really kind of a separator level, as you know, in the Southern League. Are we starting to see finally that wave of pitching starting to bubble up? I mean, Jinho Sang just got promoted up to Iowa. You know, Maples sounds like someone who could kind of force the issue here sooner rather than later. I mean, this is where if the Cubs are going to get some of those breakthrough guys and develop, you know, real homegrown pitching, it's got to happen now or here, right?
Yeah, I mean, they've been telling us that it was coming, and it has gotten there. And there's more in Myrtle Beach, and there's some guys down in South Bend. Obviously, subtracting Cease, you know, thins the herd a little bit. But they have other guys that they like a lot. And I'm expecting that we'll have some of them in double and triple A really soon. So, yeah, they've worked really hard, and that's not counting this year's draft either, you know, and all the pitching that they took with, you know, the first 10 picks. They're hoping that one of these guys will develop into a star starter. You know, so when you put enough guys in the funnel, I mean, I guess the whole thing is like, hey, if we can get one or two. But what's been surprising to me, you know, going back to Dylan Maples, it's like over the last few years, you know, you had a couple of guys you thought, hey, you know what, this guy, maybe a long shot, but they might hit with him. And then, you know, Ryan Williams got injured, and I'm not sure what his status is right now. Rob Zastrzyzny's been up here, but it, you know, hasn't stuck. And there really hasn't been that one guy who's come up besides Carl Edwards Jr. that you're like, okay, yeah, but they traded for him. But I feel like that's about to change. You know, whether it's Alzule or Dylan Maples, I think one of this group that's between AAA, AA, and High A in Myrtle Beach, I think someone's going to be up here soon and make a contribution, or they're going to trade them and they're going to do it for someone else.
I mean, we talked for years about the Cubs way. You've been there. You know, you have relationships with Kyle Schwarber, Ian Happ, Chris Bryant, all those guys that, you know, rolled through on their way to Wrigley. I mean, how would you describe Theo's style and the way he kind of cultivates these prospects, and then, you know, he falls in love with certain guys, but when a guy, and then Aroldis Chapman becomes available and he senses an opportunity, or Rick Hahn texts him saying, hey, you interested in Quintana, he really, you know, pounces and goes into stealth mode and shocks the baseball world again.
Yeah, I mean, Theo's one of the best executives ever, you know, and I think what separates him from a lot of his contemporaries is when he sees an opportunity to get big talent, he goes after it, you know, and that's exactly what happened in the draft. You know, and people say, well, they were drafting high in a lot of those rounds, really low, I guess, if you're talking about, you know, kind of flip it around, but whatever, they had a great pick, right? But they capitalized on him, you know. He's one of the most thorough people. You hear that from top to bottom, anyone that works with him, that he just, and he does a lot of stuff himself. You know, he likes to have his hands in it. He's going to trust his people, but at the same time, he's there. He's got his own formula, and that's worked for him. I mean, it is a shocking trade when you think about, you know, giving up your two best prospects and then trading with the White Sox across town. I mean, after the Sammy Sosa trade, you know, it took a long time to kind of have these two sides get together on something like this again. But it works for both teams, you know, and the Sox are trying to do the same thing the Cubs did, and that's jump on, you know, awesome elite talent. But that's what Theo's been able to do. They spend a lot of time figuring out who the people are, not just on the field but off the field. I've heard them say that before, you know, guys in the front office. Hey, you know what? He might be a great player, but he's even a better person. And I feel like that's why they won the World Series last year. You know, when character mattered, they were able to dig deep and find it. I know they're scuffling this year, but I really feel like over the course of time, you know, you got to stick with these guys because they are world champions, and you know it's eventually going to come back to the averages that they're, you know, that they run with, you know, which isn't what you look on the scoreboard here in Baltimore and see.
Really curious to hear your interview with Dylan Maples. He's a guy who Jim Hendry was told he's going to be fired. Tom Ricketts asked him to hang around and close what became a really interesting draft class headlined by Javier Baez. It sounds like one of Tim Wilkins' kind of maverick picks, taking a guy who could have, I think, punted or kicked for North Carolina and got a big bonus and really just totally fell off the map. And, you know, I was told he's got like an 80-type slider now. Who is Dylan Maples, and how surprised are you? I mean, knowing all these figures throughout the Cubs organization, longtime guys, and as well as the new waves, I mean, what are the odds of this guy exploding the way he has after, you know, really just being totally off the map after being such a big-time prospect or kind of a flashing big prospect?
Yeah, I mean, I'm watching him, and, you know, just as a fan of the organization, I'm really excited. And what they've got to do as scouts, they got to say, well, he looks so brilliant in Double A, but, you know, we've seen him in years past, and, you know, is this just a flash or is this for real? I tend to think it's for real. I mean, look, the guy's throwing 100 miles an hour. He's got this slider that's amazing. He still throws a curveball that's good. And he's able to pitch backwards as well as anyone that I've ever seen. And the problem for batters is it's like you got this, here comes this slider that he can throw and put it exactly where he wants. So he can throw it for a strike or make it appear to be a strike and throw it for a ball. And then all of a sudden he's coming back at 99. You know, he still has to develop some and maybe fastball command, something that he's working on right now. But the tools are there. And it's like, have you ever seen anything like this? I mean, not a lot. I mean, you just don't. I feel like, from what I understand, you know, maybe he was right on the cutting block at spring training this year, and maybe that's what kind of motivated him to be a little more aggressive. You know, I'm still not sure if he even knows how good he is. But just from a person that watches, you're going, okay, this is definitely different with all the swings and misses and the fastball. And so what I did was I asked some scouts that I trust. I said, look, I'm seeing this guy, and he looks absolutely brilliant. But what do you see? And he's like, you know, I gave him an 80 on his fastball. I gave him an 80 on his slider. I graded him as a number 3. The only reason I couldn't go higher is because he's not a starting pitcher. He goes, I think that he could close for the Cubs or help out in late relief this year. That's what that scout said, and this guy's been doing it 45 years, so that's his opinion, but he's turning heads. So for the Cubs, it's one of those things where eventually someone's going to have to, you know, do it. They've put so much time and effort into great, you know, drafts, you know, and you have injuries and all the other stuff that happens along the way to pitchers. But this guy, to me, is unique because he was in the last draft where you could pay players, so they basically paid him, you know, pretty high round money, first or second round, to, you know, sign in as a 14th round pick, and then Tom Ricketts flew down there and was there when he signed his contract, you know, so, you know, with Jim, I guess. So that's an amazing story, and that's why you develop players and you don't give up on guys, and the player you know, kind of compare this to the Dylan Maples story, which isn't complete yet, obviously. I mean, he could get up here and wash out. He could get hurt. He could get the AAA and it not work anymore. I don't know how it wouldn't, but it could. But Wilson Contreras, you know, no one was talking about Wilson Contreras. And I can remember him being in low A and getting reports from people I trust. And then by the time he came to Tennessee, he was not only emerging as the best player on the Smokies roster, he won the batting title, but he was a great teammate. He hustled, he played the game hard and played it with fire and passion, you know, and you guys see it now. So he had that something special, but, you know, if you would have heard the things that, you know, people reported and scouts, you know, tell you before that, you know, he wasn't even considered to be someone that could hit a 3-run homer, you know, in the series against Baltimore, and do all the other stuff he's been able to accomplish. So Dylan Maples, to me, could be that next guy.
That was Mick Gillespie, the Double-A Tennessee broadcaster, telling us about what's next. For us, we're going to be taking a break, but then after that, we'll be joined by Derek Gould. the Cardinals beat writer for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, really breaking down everything in the Cubs-Cardinals rivalry.
Keep your money local. Bring it home to a Wintrust Community Bank, home of Cubs checking with free ATMs nationwide. Find out more at wintrust.com/cubs. Members FDIC.
Well, this is Patrick Mooney of csnchicago.com with our Cubs Talk podcast, doing a little cross promotion with Derek Gould, the longtime Cardinals beat writer for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, a multimedia star on the best podcast in baseball. Derek, how you doing, man? How was your All-Star break? It looked like you got no break at all.
Yeah, I'm all right with that, though. I really enjoy the All-Star game, the All-Star festivities. It's actually, all things being equal, it might be my favorite thing to cover. I like the spectacle. I like the stories that come out of it. I like the chance that I get to write a little bit about Major League Baseball, sometimes from a Cardinals perspective, sometimes from a St. Louis perspective, but, you know, that's a little bit beyond the usual lane of covering the Cardinals beat on a day-to-day basis. So, you know, I got to go down there, write a little bit about Aaron Judge, as everybody did, and write some Max Scherzer stories and enjoy. If I were making a list of things that I enjoy covering, the All-Star game would be a topic. And if you got to give up a break to do it, that's fine. There's a good payoff.
I think from a Cubs perspective, you couldn't have found a more fitting or awkward exclamation point to the first half than an All-Star closer who had been perfect the entire first half, giving up the game-winning home run as the only representative for the Cubs, and a guy who wasn't even on last year's World Series team.
Yeah, they are the first World Series team ever not to have a representative there the next summer. I mean, how different is that from the scholarships that we saw in the All-Star game for, you know, didn't the Yankees have, 18 members of one World Series team in the All-Star game once? I kid, but it speaks to how much has been taken out of the hands of the manager. You were there, Patrick. I wonder, you know, how much he wrestled with that. I mean, you know, if he's doing this game 10 years ago, 12 years ago, he's going to be able to pick one of his guys. And this is the year where they just entirely took it out of his hand.
Yeah, I wasn't there this year, but in years past, I mean, it totally would have been like Chicago-style politics of just kind of taking care of your own and a little patronage. And I think he admitted it was awkward that, you know, they have this ceremony at Wrigley Field and all the coaches hold up their jerseys and all the guys who got him his ring are scattering across the country to go on vacation.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? I mean, I guess my thought would be like, of the 2016 Cubs, for you, who deserved or who should have been an All-Star? Bryant, because he was the MVP?
Yeah, I'd say his 2017 numbers were All-Star caliber. It's just that third base in the National League. I mean, there's no way, you know, you could make an argument, against Nolan Arenado, and there were certainly worthy selections throughout. I think Rizzo had a good first half, but to me, Ryan Zimmerman, his comeback story, you know, deserves it. And yeah. I thought Theo made an interesting point the other day of just to him, he thinks the All-Star game should not be about a three-month window, and this is a whole other kind of rabbit hole, but that you're talking about promoting the All-Star game, I think a Chris Bryant or an Anthony Rizzo, you know, deserve to be there just for kind of the way they promote the game and themselves and kind of the Cubby phenomenon. But, they didn't deserve it. You know, overall, the Cubs, there was a disappointing, underachieving first half, and they've certainly come roaring out of the gates here in the second half after the Jose Quintana trade.
I am okay just to kind of echo what what Theo said there is that I'm okay if the All-Star game is a showcase of who fans want to see or even who baseball wants to see. I mean, there was some hand-wringing here in St. Louis about Yadier Molina's election to the All-Star game, right? Like, was he worthy? Was he ahead of other catchers and everything? And while that was a thin position this year, I mean, it should take note that his peers voted him in, you know, mm-hmm. so somebody wanted to see him play, and then he goes and hits a home run and has a good time, and, you know, I mean, so it's okay. Like, if they were to say, hey, the MVP always goes, you know, or even the people want to see the MVP, or people want to see the ambassadors, like Theo suggests, I'm game for that. That's what the All-Star game should be about. It should be about taking a photo with the umpire behind home plate, and it should never have been about this whole it counts nonsense.
One of my favorite kind of awkward power struggles from last summer was Derek Fowler had this kind of nagging injury leading up to the All-Star break, and obviously he had a huge first half, but the timing was bad, and the Cubs didn't want to tell him, no, you're shut down. But he said, well, I'm not going to, you know, jeopardize the second half. And then finally, you know, they came to this agreement where he'd go to the All-Star game, but obviously not play because he hadn't played for the actual Cubs.
Right.
But obviously Derek Fowler going to the Cardinals, a lot was made about his energy, his personality, and, you know, unprompted, a Cubs person a couple weeks ago said to me, you know, we miss obviously Derek Ross because people can't stop talking about him. Sorry, David Ross, but that
David Ross, yeah.
Not, but that Fowler was someone who quietly maybe got on guys or pushed them. I didn't necessarily see that, but I did think his just production at the top of the lineup was just so huge. He was this spark catalyst for the team. How has he fit in St. Louis, and can he do that for the Cardinals here in the second half?
So he's not fit in as imagined, to be honest. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not batting leadoff. He is now the number three hitter, which he is putting on a good face about if he thought that was a good idea or if he's okay with it. He told me once that Barry Bonds, who, as you know, he works out with
right.
In the offseason, he said Bonds has been on him and said that he could be a number three hitter. He should be a number three hitter. And, you know, he's hit for some more power this season. And, you know, Matt Carpenter is so comfortable in the leadoff spot. But so he's in a new spot. You know, it's just fascinating because, you know, so they have a guy in Matt Carpenter who's been one of the best leadoff hitters in the National League for several years. They want to move him out. They find that, okay, well, he wasn't doing all that well in the third spot. They move him back to leadoff, and he takes off. Tommy Pham comes up and plays exceptional. He's a plus defensive player in center field. And all of a sudden, two of the things that they got Dexter Fowler to do, they have other people doing. And, you know, so it's put him in an interesting spot, and it's put the Cardinals in an interesting spot, too. You know, he's got this chronic heel spur, foot trouble, that he said linked to the injury he had last season, which you talked about, uh-huh. and then caused more leg problems this season. So inevitably that invites the question, do you think he should move to a corner spot if the Cardinals have, you know, defensive players who can handle center field? I mean, just look at this series, right? Mm-hmm. On the first game of the Mets series, they have Tommy Pham in left, Dexter Fowler in center, and Magnera Sierra in right. All things being equal, not one of those people was in the outfield position that would have given the best defense, right? I mean, Sierra is a superb defensive center fielder. Pham has a lot of experience in right field. And Fowler, with the, you know, with his arm and with where he is and may eventually be, he'd be the left fielder in that situation. It's just, it's an interesting thing. And then you kind of couple that. Somebody was asking me today in St. Louis on the radio if Fowler seems unhappy. And I said, well, consider his situation. He looks up at the scoreboard. He sees an average that he doesn't recognize. Mm-hmm. He sees an on-base percentage that he doesn't recognize. He sees a home run total that is nice, but, yeah, doesn't recognize. He sees a spot in the order that he doesn't recognize. And he's dealing with us, asking him questions about whether he should be the center fielder or not, which is a position change that he doesn't recognize. Oh, and he's wearing a Cardinals uniform, which is a uniform new to him that he doesn't recognize. So, I mean, would you be happy? I don't know. I didn't cover him as long as you did, but I would imagine just from being around the game, there are very few guys who, when they are not performing well, can be the life of a clubhouse. When they're not producing well, can be the life of a clubhouse. When they are not doing the things that are expected of them or that their contract says the team should expect from them, they can be leaders. It takes a special guy who can do that. I don't know if Fowler was that guy for the Cubs, but I can understand why, you know, he'd wait to produce a little bit more before being a little bit more vocal in a new clubhouse to him.
Yeah, that was the thing to me with Fowler. I never really thought he was that guy. I thought it was more just, I think you saw it in Game 7 of the World Series, that spontaneous kind of backwards backpedaling after hitting that home run. And then he brought a swagger on the field, and he put up numbers, and he was certainly a good guy to deal with. He was professional, but he was not particularly loud or vocal in the clubhouse. And I think, you know, from afar, it seems like the Cardinals have gone through this, and the Cubs are certainly going through this now of kind of finding an identity or a chemistry, and just how elusive that can be.
Yeah, well, and it's no surprise that until recently they were both losing teams in the standings. So, those things go hand in hand. I see in the Cubs, and people who have maybe heard our podcast here in St. Louis or are tired of me writing, but I think I see a lot of similarities in the 2017 Cubs with the 2016 Cardinals. Mm-hmm. In 2015, the Cardinals go out and win 100 games and lose in the division series to a Cubs team. But they, partially because of the power that Cubs team had, that lineup that the Cubs had. But the Cardinals that year, one of the reasons why they were so good through the course of a whole season was because how sharp they played. I mean, they were one of the best run prevention teams you and I will ever see. And then along came the 2016 Cubs, who were one of the best run prevention teams we'll ever see. And, yeah, they relied on outliers to pull that off. Historically good pitching, like the Cubs got in 2016 and like the Cardinals got in 2015. And then when, 2016 started for the Cardinals, some of those same things didn't happen. The magic wasn't there. All of a sudden a mistake in the defense led to a loss. They had such a slim margin for error, and then all of a sudden they were playing a kind of brand of baseball that they didn't recognize. And, yeah, that led to, some questioning in the clubhouse, some questioning on the field, and it ultimately meant that they didn't make the playoffs. And I think, watching the Cubs play, I would bet, and they may even say this, but I would bet that they don't recognize their game at times. Maybe they do now after Susan Leoria. But there for a long time, there looked to be some perplexed faces, like, "What? This is not how we should play. This is not what should be going on. This is not the team I reckon." I mean, Kyle Schwarber was personified that, right? He didn't recognize his game. Mm-hmm. And so I see a lot of similarities there. But the Cubs have the lineup and the talent to still overcome that, whereas the Cardinals have yet to really find that lineup to overcome any of their little minor failings.
Yeah, I remember that exact story you had written. I think it was previewing a previous Cubs-Cardinals series about the 2015-2016 kind of drop-off hangover. Yeah. And I think seeing how the Cubs responded to the Quintana trade, and I know it's the Orioles and their starting pitching is really bad and there's inevitable bump the Cubs should get off of kind of an all-star break and feeling refreshed, but I did notice a different kind of vibe around the team, and I'm kind of wondering, you've written this, it seems like Mozeliak, even almost game to game, you can make a case either what they should do at the deadline or which needs they should address. I mean, ultimately over the next several days here, and you've made this point, maybe it's not as clear-cut as buyers or sellers, but what do you anticipate happening, and do they have maybe another shakeup coming here in St. Louis?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think one way or the other, they want to. You know, I mean, I don't know quite yet which direction they're gonna kind of bend. I'd get the sense that they might look at both. You know, they might mm-hmm. go, they might look in, you know, to both buy and sell, or it was interesting. I think one of the readers there on the chat at scltoday.com kind of brought up was like, you know, one of the things that Mozeliak tends to do is declutter the roster. I think that's a really good description, and he does. You know, I talked to him about this. I didn't use the phrase declutter because I'm not sure he would have been all that eager to answer a decluttering question. He might have taken issue with the clutter notion. But, you know, this idea that, you know, back in 2011, right, they had a depreciating asset in Colby Rasmus. The manager made it very clear that he was not going to play him. Colby had a lot of talent, and a lot of teams are calling, saying, hey, this is a guy we want. Maybe can we buy low on him? And so Mozeliak had to make a call, like, is this an asset that is going to be worth its most right now, get me the most right now, or is that something to wait in the off season? And the play of John Jay, current Chicago Cub John Jay, mm-hmm. made it possible to then also look at trading Rasmus and creating a bit of a refresh of some other areas, like the bullpen, adding Dotel, adding Zepchinski, adding Brian Talbot, Zepchinski, that's who it was, adding Zepchinski for a bit. And the, you know, that worked. You know, Dotel became the brawn, you know, neutralizer mm-hmm. in the NLCS, and Zepchinski brought a lefty reliever that the Cardinals really didn't have, you know, and also just adding a new look to the bullpen led to what you saw in October, which was a very aggressive use of the bullpen in Tony La Russa's swan song. So that was definitely a refresh of the roster, sort of an addition by subtraction, too, because it cleared up the clubhouse of any sort of Colby Rasmus confusion. John Jay was the guy, and away they went. Fast forward 3 years, and you got 2014, again involving a current Cub with John Lackey, you know, and the Cardinals had a guy in Alan Craig who was really struggling, was not himself, did not look anything like the hitter he had been, and yet the manager continued to trot him out there in the hopes that today would be the day that he caught fire and became the Alan Craig of memory. And they did that 23 times with their fingers crossed, or 27 times with their fingers crossed, and he continued to struggle. And in the meanwhile, there was Oscar Taveras, the late Oscar Taveras, who was a rising star. And the front office wanted him to play, wanted to make sure that he played, and they moved Alan Craig, a guy, again, who they saw as a diminishing asset or a problematic contract. And by trading him and Joe Kelly, they got Lackey, the starter that they desperately needed to give them innings, and then, of course, the best starter of the 100-win team the next year. On a minimum contract of all things, and got playing time for Oscar Taveras. So, you know, but seeing if those two things are possible this year is, and I'm sorry for going on here, but it's a little trickier. You know, where's the young guy pushing for playing time? There's not really a Colby Rasmus type guy who's just sitting there. So, you know, an overhaul could be a little bit trickier, but it also could be more important than ever because the problems, and this is kind of the crux of it, the problems of 2017 aren't going away. Mm-hmm. They'll be there in 2018 unless they address them.
I remember we were in Nashville at the winter meetings, and it was the post-David Price fallout. Jason Hayward hadn't made his decision yet. You had written about this idea of the Cardinals getting out of their comfort zone and having to extend themselves financially or do something that maybe on paper didn't make sense. And I'm not sure if they've actually gone through with any of those, that type of dramatic move yet. I mean, could this deadline be where they do something we never saw coming and give up a bunch of prospects or do like just do something that would, you know, kind of blow the roof off? And what is that still on the table, or do they just kind of keep kind of down this path that has been successful for a long time, or do you wonder if maybe some of this slippage, whether it's, you know, defense, base running, you know, all of a sudden there is this kind of reckoning? I don't know. How do you see?
Yeah, that's a great word. That's a great word for it, a reckoning. So what we saw with the Cardinals, like, you know, they extended and would have tried to go, or they made an offer to Price, but they knew that they were going to just be trounced by Boston and were by a significant amount. Then, you know, they made the offer to Hayward, which, you know, the total value of what the Cubs offered because of that second, opt-out, right? Mm-hmm. It could be worth more to Hayward in the long run. But as Hayward told us, I think you were there, right?
He
thought the Cardinals would have offered it if he had asked for it.
Mm-hmm.
The Cubs did not give him a no-trade clause. The Cardinals did. And, you know, Hayward didn't mince words. He said the Cardinals offered more money.
Mm-hmm.
He just wanted the better situation. So that's two times the Cardinals tried to extend and were in both cases were told no, which I think is more fascinating than the fact that they were willing to extend. And then for Fowler, they did.
Right.
You know, I was told multiple times that the description I got was that they had to go over the top, meaning well over any other offer to
mm-hmm.
get Fowler. And that is likely that fifth year. You know, a place where the Cardinals would have been reluctant to go in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But the market told them that, and that was the player they wanted, so off they went. I think you used a great word, the reckoning. The market has moved beyond their model. They have to change their model. The market is saying that Adam Eaton can command that many prospects, that Chris Sale can command that many prospects. The market is dictating that, no longer their model. And the Cardinals are big on collecting the future. They're big on it, and they have, for the most part, created an annual contender through complementary players. However, they are a team in need of a dynamo. They don't have that guy right now. They don't have enough of those guys right now, to be honest. They don't have the fulcrum of the lineup, and they haven't developed it, and they acknowledge internally that there isn't one coming. So it's time to trade from their depth. You know, they have a good farm system, and they've worked really hard to get there. It's going to take a bite because they didn't have the picks this year. But I think they want to break from character. I think they want to try to do it. They just have to figure out who's the right guy and if that right guy is available to pull it off. I think they're almost like the wallflower at the dance who is really, really hesitant ask the best looking girl to dance, even though they might have the best moves, you know? And it's just like, you know, you have to make that leap eventually.
Well, you had, in terms of analogies, I want to make sure I pronounce his name right, the new GM, Mike Gersh.
Yep, Gersh. Yep.
You had a really
Chicago
cool,
kid.
Yeah. You had a really cool Q&A with him, recently promoted, like you said, Chicago guy, and he use this phrase like the puke point of make an offer or kind of a trade scenario, and you know, will you how excited will you get, how sick will you get? You know, we've seen the Cubs do this extreme tear down. I know your papers kind of floated this idea before, but you know, seeing what an ex-Cardinals guy did with the Astros,
mm-hmm.
is there any more of an appetite to maybe not fully go tanking, but to punt on season and to realize that to get Chris Bryant or some of these amateur talents that you have to go all the way down to the bottom? Or from an ownership's perspective, is that just not something you can do with the best fans in baseball and, you know, kind of this ballpark village that they've created in downtown St. Louis?
Yeah. So the owner says, we don't believe in windows. His whole thing is $3.4 million through the gate and 90 wins on the board. And he wants them to average that over 3-5 year cycles and not dip below it. So, so that doesn't mean that they win 90 games every year. It just means over the course of time, they average 90 wins. Mm-hmm. That's sort of a rough estimate of where they think that'll get you in the playoffs every year. Does that mean, again, a championship? It does not, because as you guys know, and as Theo first brought to my attention way back in 2004 when I was talking to him as the GM of the Red Sox, it was like, you just got to get in and see what happens, right? Mm-hmm. That Red Sox team is a great example of that. The 83-win Cardinals of 2006 are a good example of that. Just get in, and everything else is random from there, or it's Madison Bumgarner. Those are the things that determine October. So that's how the ownership sees it, and I'm not sure that they see a way to collapse like Houston did, purposefully losing and losing faith or losing the trust of the fan base to then arise again. I think it would be such a breach of brand. Mm-hmm. It'd be tough. I mean, you think about what the Cardinals are known for, right? I mean, think about what they sell. They try to sell their history. They try to sell a style of baseball. And they try to sell this idea that they're always going to be winning. You know how many losing seasons they've had under this ownership? You know, I mean, look, Mike Matheny had never been 3 games below 500 this late in the season. That's bonk. He'd never got to the All-Star break with a losing record.
Wow.
Tony La Russa had one losing season since... I mean, I haven't seen a losing season, right?
Yeah, I think there was one since 2000 or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean that is their identity, and so there is a public contract there or a public trust for the type of team that they're going to be, and look, Houston's a cautionary tale, right? How good is that team? How are they drawing? You know, isn't there like almost like a fool me once type of look down there? I get it; it's a much bigger town, and there's other things going on there, but that's a really good baseball team. And how are they doing at the gate? I don't know.
Their TV ratings were like, I think they registered as zeros, and CSN cycled out, and then Root Sports came in. So, I think the Cubs just had an exceptional kind of sense of desperation and fan loyalty to where they could do it. I think you're right. I don't think it's a sustainable or a blueprint you can really copy.
Well, and also, Wrigley Field was the draw, right? You could still make Wrigley Field the draw regardless of what was going on the field. You could make that a social experience and sort of count on that while, it's a bit of sleight of hand, right? Look at the left hand and all the ivy and all the wonder of coming and, the CNBC at Wrigley Field. When, meanwhile, the left hand was completely retooling the organization. And also the messaging. I mean, that was huge. They did a really good job, and you were in the front lines of the coverage of this, and, please push back if I'm wrong. But I thought they did a really good job, Theo and Jed, of being face forward. And
no doubt.
Saying, look, this is what we're doing. And they were able to sell it. Now, the risk there is if it didn't work, then they would have lost credibility. And that would have been hard to come back from. And you see that in organizations, right, all over baseball. The five-year plan that suddenly goes at the end of year four, well, it's going to be a seven-year plan. And then you kick the can down a little bit more. No, now, I've been in the role 9 year, but we're really close to having this 12-year plan in place. They had to make good on their promise, but it helped that they were very candid about their promise.
You brought up Mike Matheny, and I'm just curious because when we're talking about the chicken or egg element to clubhouse chemistry, maybe the Cardinals' way that style maybe has been a little off over the last couple of years, and I realize social media, you hear certain voices louder than others, and I do think there's an element of manager fatigue. I mean, you see it. I mean, Joe Maddon won Game 7 of the World Series and got questions for months about you know, how he handled it. But, I mean, Mike Matheny, how is he viewed, I guess, from a media perspective, from a fan base perspective, and ultimately from a front office ownership perspective?
Well, ownership gave him an extension this past winter. You know, so he's coming off his first season where he didn't make the playoffs, and he got an extension that gave him security beyond most of the players. And at the time, all but one of the players he had security for. So that was something. And it also gave him financial security, which is a big thing for him. So ownership gave him that, which was a tremendous show of faith, and maybe fits into what we're talking about what the roster lacks. They certainly made it a point that this is the manager who is going to lead them, and that he could even be the face of the franchise, whereas maybe some of the players could be interchangeable. I thought that was a very interesting thing. So we don't have any question about whether, whether the ownership has faith in him. You know, the front office is working with him to try to help him improve. You know, that's always the part of this game is, you know, he did not have any coaching or managing experience before he got to it. So, you know, I had a conversation, I don't remember if it was early in the season or during spring training, but there was this thing that Mike said to ESPN.com, Mark Saxon. It was a Q&A when Mark Saxon was with ESPN.com and really was providing a lot of good coverage there. Kind of a really welcome voice on the beat. But Mike took this very, very direct shot at the media. He has since gone to several members of the media and apologized for it or sought to reframe it. I was not one of them. But anyway, he said that that there are something along the lines of there are a lot of smart people that cover the team, but they would never be an allowance for inexperience. And he said, you know, they expect these guys to arrive fully formed, and don't allow for a learning curve within the majors, you know, because they were relying on a lot of young players. And I listened to him like, right, I read the comments, and I go, I understand what he's saying, but what I don't understand is how he could claim that that was us doing it, because we were the ones asking about why does a kid make a mistake like Colton Wong and then vanish from the lineup for 3 days? Why does Randall Grichuk strike out 3 times in a game and then go a series without playing? At some point in time, don't you just have to commit to these guys because that's the team you have? And if they perform, then you win. And if they don't, then at least you gave it a shot. But the constant yo-yoing of guys in and out on this arbitrary basis of who made mistakes and who didn't, or whose view of their mistakes is worse, it just seemed wrong. And what really got me was we had just covered 4 years of his development, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he is a prospect. He is in the majors with no time in the minors to learn how to handle a bullpen, no time to put together a lineup. I mean, he had all the time in the majors as a player, and it was a very inquisitive, very thoughtful, very instinctual, very aware and curious player, and collected all sorts of information because he was always told, hey, someday you're going to be a manager. Hey, someday you're going to be a manager. So he prepared for that, and that's a credit to him. But I just thought it was interesting that he was describing how little patience the media, he in his mind, had for inexperience when we had just covered him through his development phase. So that's you asked how the media perceives him. I think that's part of it. I think that's like, wait a minute, you know, we see you developing on the job, whether it's in your interaction with us, your interaction with players, or your interaction with the management, or even your interaction with strategy. And, you know, that now, you know, at what point in time is that over? I mean, if he were a player, he would now be nearing his final year of arbitration and looking towards free agency. To me, that's probably when it's over. You know, you missed the playoffs 1 year. That's quaint around here. You missed the playoffs 2 years in a row. That's not so good, right?
Yeah, no, and especially the team of George Kissel, etc. They're supposed to be finished
the
products when they get there too, right? I mean, the Cardinal
right.
way.
Well, but that's changing though. I mean, yeah. How often do you see that? I mean, you see these 21, 22-year-olds at the game, and you know, this is a topic that maybe is gaining more traction, and we're going to hear more about. I'm fascinated by it. I'm sure you've heard it as well. I heard it from some scouts here a lot this year, is that in the race to get players to the majors younger, and yes, that's code for cheaper, but also into their peak years, mm-hmm. You know, they're missing out on some of the traditional development milestones. You know, 13 years ago, 12 years, actually not as long as that, maybe 12 years ago, I did a story about a player for the Cardinals named Darryl Jones, an outfielder, who was highly thought of as an athlete, had a lot of the loose kind of raw traits that they look for in a baseball player. But they realized that this was a development guy. And so I spent time with him in Quad Cities at the low A team there when the Cardinals had it. And you know, just kind of talk through these different milestones and used him as an example of what players throughout the entire system, what they were trying to do with them. You know, and that goes from, okay, hey, at this level, you got to have fastball command. Okay, at this level, you got to have off-speed command. Mm-hmm. Okay, at this level, you got to do these. And now you see players fast forward. I mean, the Cardinals starting right fielder yesterday started the season in high A. He went from high A to the majors.
Wow.
He's instinctual. He's gifted. He's very good. But if he doesn't throw to the right base, isn't it entirely possible that it's because he just hasn't had the time to learn that, to make that second nature, to make that muscle memory, because he never had to do it at the speed, and now he has to do it in the major leagues because he just skipped over? So it's like a sixth grader being, you know, skipping two grades and going into, you know, whatever, you know, pre-calc, and the teacher holding it against them that he doesn't know what a derivative is. Well, he hasn't had a chance to learn the fundamentals, right? So we're missing some of that as we speed young guys through. I'm not saying that it's wrong that these young guys get there. The game is better because an Aaron Judge isn't stuck in AAA because of some quota he has to fill for a bat. The game is better because Kyle Schwarber or Chris Bryant get to the majors quicker and don't have to hit these milestones of 1,000 at bats in the minors. But you know, but the game might be better, but how it's played or how it's taught needs to be different. I was told by a farm director, Pat, real quick, about 10 years ago, they said, "Hey, the way we're developing players is good. It's working out well. We just have to do it 3 years faster."
This is an oversimplification, but you know, looking ahead to this weekend, you mentioned Matheny's kind of learning curve, and he had a T-shirt comment to you in spring training. Dexter Fowler, Jason Hayward, obviously they ultimately made different decisions, but I never got the sense that either one of them was going to be doing cartwheels towards St. Louis in terms of that Cardinal way, that clubhouse culture seems to be a little more buttoned up. How much do you think the Cubs get under the Cardinals' skin, even if these differences are more superficial and media-driven?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's a very interesting question because I would have a really direct answer if Tony La Russa was still the manager,
right?
Because it would be obvious. I think there is a recognition of how good the Cubs were or are. I think Mike was really clear about that early on. You go back to 2014. I believe it was, 2014, when the Cubs were on the upswing there late in the season. Mm-hmm. And Mike was effusive in praise mm-hmm. about them. But also kind of like one of these like respectful rival type things. Like, all right, that's the guy, you know, who's going to come along or that's the team that has the ability to come along and knock us off. And we got to be aware of that. That's the team that's coming on our heels and be aware of it. And he talked a lot about that. I mean, so I think he was appropriately respectful, you know, whereas Tony would have played it a little bit like Madden did, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you look back to 14 and 15 and how Madden played that, you know, with the Tony Soprano in the dugout over there.
Right, yeah.
Right? He was totally trying to set it up like the Cubs were the scrappy underdogs taking on the meanest villain in town, you know. They were Elliot Ness and the Cardinals were Al Capone. That's what was happening. And they were going to win it the Chicago way. And, you know, he played that narrative. And then you saw it bend, like, all right, you know, got to win at Busch. Remember, you know, you got to learn how to win
right.
at a cathedral. You know, and then toward the end of that season, in that last series, he talked about how he goes, I think we've proven that we're their equal. We've proven that they're equal. And then the playoff series happened, and Madden talked about how they've proven that they're better.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a whole evolution there that was like a four-act Shakespeare play from underdog to champion. And at no point in time was that reciprocated by the Cardinals. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
The Cardinals were like, no, you know, we're not either lapsing into this narrative or we're not playing along or any number of things. Or it just isn't in Mike's personality. I mean, even when I remember being there at Wrigley and I'm like, Mike, they just hit 4,200 of your guys with pitches. Don't you have a problem with that?
Mm-hmm.
And he just would not comment. He
mm-hmm.
just wouldn't say anything. He wouldn't fall into that trap or wouldn't take the bait or however he viewed it. He just wouldn't. So I think now that the Cubs are world champs, I think there's a genuine sense around the clubhouse that, all right, finally, that's over. Now, moving on.
Okay.
So I think they see the Cubs as equals. I think they see the Cubs as an equal without the magic now. You know, they got their titles.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on, I think they definitely see the Cubs as the team to chase. I know that for a fact. They think if they're going to win this division this year, they have to do it against the Cubs. Whether or not that's overlooking the Brewers to their own detriment, we'll find out. But I don't think there is. I don't think there's the friction that would exist if Tony were still the manager. And I think Mike is purposeful in that. He wants it definitely to make it about the Cardinals, not make it about playing to annoy the Cubs.
Derek, thank you so much for your insight.
But can I ask you some questions?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Okay, all right. So they got Quintana. And that was the pitcher that they needed. Everybody knew. So I wanted to ask you a few things about that real quick. Are they done? Do they think one pitcher is enough that it writes the balance? Or do you see them adding, even if it's not like a highfalutin pitcher, but like an innings guy to kind of bring balance to the rotation?
Yeah.
Think that's possible?
Yeah, I don't think the Sonny Gray rumors, I never got the sense that was – there was much traction to that. I think it was more Theo doing a favor for Billy Bean and messing with the Brewers. And sure, the Cubs would like Sonny Gray. Who wouldn't? But I think you're looking at a farm system that doesn't have many headliners left. And in terms of that sense of urgency, the willingness to, pay that tax or to be the urgency to win a bidding war, I don't quite see it for a Sonny Gray, but they're always looking for pitching. It's this huge kind of hole within their system. They addressed part of it with Quintana that, you know, they're preparing for Lackey and Arrieta to move on. You do see other parts of the roster after Miguel Montero talked his way out of the clubhouse. They could use a veteran backup catcher. I think another reliever this idea of strengthening a strength
right.
could be in play. And certainly if that kind of a more of like a buy low type starting pitcher, the way they did with Mike Montgomery last year, mm-hmm. to see if they could groom someone within this pitching infrastructure, I think that's in play. And, you know, Theo made a point of saying we're going to kind of take a deep breath and look and kind of take a step back and see how this team plays. And they've certainly responded by winning their first four games out of the All-Star break. And I think as we get closer, there's a couple of, I guess you'd call them redundancies, guys like Jamer Candelario, a third baseman, first baseman, switch hitter who doesn't really fit, you know, who might be able to get them a piece and kind of looking down the line. And I think, you know, we've all seen Theo that he's not afraid to strike. So I do think you'll see them do something else. I don't think it'll approach anywhere the magnitude of Quintana. Although a crosstown trade like that, a bombshell, would be hard to top no matter what.
Right. Yeah. That was huge. And out of the ether too. You know, right as everybody's coming down from the All-Star game, pow. You know, mm-hmm. there it goes. So you hit on two things there that I hope you can maybe illuminate, you know, especially for like kind of a Cardinals fan base, is the Cubs, their farm system, is it enough to sustain their aspirations of dynastic hold on this division? Can their farm system do that? Because I look and I see a team that had no homegrown pitchers on their World Series roster that still needs pitching, that hasn't been able to produce, kind of an in-house starter, and then just traded their top pitching prospect to get Quintana. So do they have enough in place? Do they have enough on the farm to sort of feed their aspirations?
That's a great question, Derek. I think Theo would start by saying, he said something like this in Baltimore, like, well, I'd rather have Ian Happ hitting 13 bombs in the majors than being our number one prospect in the minors. And that, you know,
yep.
they have these young position player guys that are going to become a lot more expensive through the arbitration process. They have a TV deal on the horizon, which you've written about a ton, this idea of will the bubble burst? Obviously, they'll get more, but, you know, just how much? They've pretty much been told, both from ownership and looking at the ramifications of the new CBA, that going over the luxury tax is not really something that they're going to be doing. So that's kind of an artificial ceiling that's been put in place. That's what makes this Quintana deal so huge, that I asked Theo about that affordable contract, and he admitted that when you get a contract and a talent like that, you're almost reflexively looking at the other guy you could bring along with that, that his contract just opens up all these different possibilities. So whether it's, Yu Darvish this winter, or if it's that monster free agent class, I have a hard time seeing, you know, actually going through with Bryce Harper, but you're going to hear those type of rumors. Or if, you know,
because of the Vegas connection.
Yeah. And if Ohtani, obviously,
yeah, yeah.
right now that's kind of a capped, restricted thing. But if a talent like that all of a sudden emerges, or if he decides to wait it out, you know, they have a lot more options. So they put a ton of faith in Chris Bosio and his coaching staff to take an Arrieta or a Hendricks and kind of mold them up into something totally different or unexpected. And I think some of that magic, this season at least, has been kind of zapped a bit. And,
yeah.
you know, they'll keep throwing out the change of scenery, guys. They finally use their top picks on pitchers, college pitchers, this draft. So time will tell if they could, you know, actually get them through, you know, multiple levels of this farm system. And, you know, I think there are a couple of guys. That was kind of been our running joke of whenever you ask Theo about the pitching, like every year at Cubs convention, he says, oh, there's some interesting guys at A-ball, and mentions people no one's ever heard of really before or since, but some of those guys now are actually getting to double A and kind of knocking on the door at triple A. So they're certainly aware of that. That's something they think about all the time, but it is the kind of, if it doesn't happen, if this second half falls off and if, you know, they're scrambling and, you know, overreact this winter, that was part of the Quintana logic too, of they knew how desperate it would look to try and get two starting pitchers this winter, and they had to act now.
Yeah. It's interesting because, like, you look at when the Cubs started all this, and they were rather candid about, you know, they wanted the annual cycle of success and contention like the Cardinals had, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the Cardinals feed it from within. That's the spot where they got to under John Mozeliak, because they were able to feed this team that, you know, again, could shoot for 90 wins with some complementary players and excellent pitching from within, you know, to kind of, that's how they fed their contention every year. You know, so they were good and every so often great, but good, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the Cardinals always thought, I mean, they saw the Cubs as a rising behemoth, the Leviathan of the North, because it was, if they could do that, if they could replicate the Cardinals' front, you know, farm system and approach to sustaining annual contention, then they could do it with bigger money, and they could do it in a bigger market.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the Cardinals' fear. And I look now, and I wonder if really what's happened is the Cubs, because of the inability to, you know, develop pitching, which you always need pitching depth. You can't always go out and buy it.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you have to go out and buy it, and one of those guys who's expensive falters, then you tumble. You know, if they have the Red Sox, where they're good, 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 down. Good, good, down. Good, 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 down. You know, if that's what happens, if this plan to be the Cardinals with money, instead they just become the Red Sox.
Yeah, I think, and some of this is, I think, retrofitting and making it up as they go along, but Theo basically just doesn't trust young pitching, that if he's going to place his bets on trades and the draft, he did it on hitters, and that, you know, he looks at the Mets, yeah, like everything came together in 2015, but it's really impossible, really hard to kind of plan around pitching. And I think that kind of resonated around Cubs fans who looked at Mark Pryor and Kerry Wood and Carlos Zambrano. And so that's kind of where they're at.
That great point.
They know that there's going to be probably a year or two where, you know, that pitching, they are completely exposed, you know, by it. And, you know, I do think you've seen part of it this year too, of which you got to give the Cardinals credit for how, the way they came back year after year after year, that it's draining playing into November. And it's also, you know, there's no really kind of instruction manual for how to deal with winning a World Series as a Cub, and that when all these guys are flooded with endorsements and they play in a city where sports is it, that, you know, the way politics is in D.C., you know, Gordon Whitmire, you know, our colleague, you know, has made that point of, in L.A., it's Hollywood, in D.C., it's politics, in Chicago, it's sports. And these guys, you know, when the Cubs were last place team, you know, their players were taken care of everywhere, you know, in River North. And I do think you have kind of Madden. You talk about Matheny's security. I think, you know, obviously this guy's a World Series manager, but he took a lot of heat and a lot of even internal kind of second guessing over, you know, how things were handled. And, you know, when you say Theo, when Theo says this team is playing without an edge and all the answers are within the clubhouse, well, that's not a great reflection on the manager. And
that's right.
I do think, you know, there's a lot of kind of tension within that kind of, you know, dynasty you're talking about, and it's going to be up to the Cubs to figure out how to handle it and, you know, stay hungry And yeah, find some pitchers.
Yeah, I mean, I have one other quick question for you, but I think it's one of the things about not having pitching and always going out to buy it is that's a great plan for October, and it'll help you thrive as a team. Mm-hmm. But to help you survive, you got to have depth, and that depth has to be internal because, like you said, there's a limited budget. So if you don't have a sixth starter that you can choose, that you can turn to, that's a guy who's a 0-3, just to even handle innings, you'd be surprised how little you survive. I mean, that is always something that catches up because then you're doing what the Cardinals did for a while, which was go Sidney Ponson fishing.
Well, yeah, and then this idea that, you know, Jake Arrieta, you know, hey, change of scenery every time they acquire some, you know, failed prospect or, you know, guy who was a first-round pick. I mean, Jake Arrieta, this is one of the greatest runs we'll ever see in a second half there. And you know, there was a lot to Jake when he got to Chicago, and there's a lot up in his head and kind of in terms of want to and desire.
Yeah.
It was just like this perfect storm, and to think that's going to happen – maybe it's not foolish, but it's hard to count on, you know, another Jake Arrieta walking through your doors from AAA.
Right. Okay, so last question. Since you're the old expert at this and I am new to it, I need your help, and maybe you can help describe what we should expect. Front office set up with a president who's a former GM and a GM who's a former GM. In our case, a new GM, but the former assistant GM. How does that work? How do you see that work? Do you hear them saying different things? Do they present different sides? How does that work? And how has Theo and Jed made it work where there isn't an ego arm wrestling contest or there isn't two voices on the same subject? How does this work?
Well, I think there's a lot of layers to it, and obviously the Cardinals did an internal promotion, and that's even though Jed came from an outside organization, he had worked with Theo before. I think part of it is just how much the job has grown. I think from media demands to the 24/7, 365 nature of the job, that's a bigger job than what it used to be. And I think practically speaking, Theo and Jed both have young families. They'd like to continue seeing their families and having families, and that it helps in that regard when you're splitting up, you know, road trips or certain duties. I think part of it is Theo's personality that, you know, they kind of divide it up, you know, there are certain agents or teams that Jed has better relationships with, or that, you know, Theo throws his arms up with, you know, certain guys, or, you know, I think he has a quick trigger temper compared to Jed, and that Jed is kind of the one who balances him out, that Theo's the one that wants to step on the gas immediately, whereas Jed, I think, kind of walks him back from certain things. So there's that personality dynamic as well.
Good.
It's logistics. Yeah. And, you know, they're both, you know, came up in Boston at a time when the Red Sox recovered, you know, like no one else. You know, I think that's the easy part in terms of staying on message because they both, I think, have, you know, a similar thought process. They look at the game from a certain way. And it just, like you said, it's the way the game's gone. And from your perspective, I guess, is a way to keep Mozeliak around and engaged and interested too, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's long overdue. They were going to do it a while back, but then the hacking thing broke, and they wanted to bring some stability and obviously see how that sorted out. So that put a delay. I mean, this is something they've been talking about for a while, and they don't hide from the fact that the setup with the Cubs and the job that Theo has, that they recognize that Mo had accomplished a lot, that Mo had significant accomplishments in his career, and that, you know, the owner told me once, Chairman Bill DeWitt told me once that he goes, look, Mo's peers all have the president title. And that was something that he wanted to remedy if they could or find a way to make work. So it's interesting. You know, that personality part is really just to kind of tie everything back together, that personality mesh, if you will, how their gears pull together, like, you know, one pushes and the other one pulls back, you know, one plays with the gut, the other one plays with the numbers, that kind of thing. If the Cardinals were to eventually get to that point where Gersh and Mo have different views and maybe one is willing to go past the puke point and risk a stomach ulcer, then that would be very interesting. And that would be the break from character that you were asking about earlier.
After every Cubs game, stay tuned for Cubs Post Game Live, sponsored by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois, with David Kaplan and David DeJesus. Hear from Cubs players inside the locker room. Get a live look inside Joe Maddon's post game press conferences and more.
Welcome back to the Cubs Talk podcast and the calm before the storm of the Cardinals coming into Wrigley Field for three games this weekend, and then the crosstown renewing. Always fireworks there. Two games at Wrigley, two games on the south side. You got the awkwardness of Rick Renteria coming back to Wrigley, and then Jose Quintana hopefully pitching against his old team would be another great storyline. To keep track of everything, tune into Cubs Talk podcast, brought to you by Wintrust, home of Cubs checking with free ATMs nationwide. Find out more at wintrust.com/Cubs. You can find all of our podcasts at csnchicago.com/podcasts or subscribe on Apple Podcasts. We're also available on Google Play, Stitcher, and Audio Boom. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week.